This podcast contains uncensored profanity and topics not intended for all audiences. This episode in particular is about parasites, and we mention sensitive topics like sex and mild body horror. So if you don't want to hear about that kind of thing, this is your opportunity to turn it off and enjoy the rest of your day undisturbed. But if you do want to learn what our favorite parasites are, then welcome, right this way, to Spellbound and Gagged with me, Ellen Weatherford, and special guest, Katie Golden. Hello, Katie Golden.
Hey there.
I am excited to speak to you once again. We've spoken before. We've spoken a couple of times here and there.
Yeah.
I've been on your podcast. You've been on my podcast. It's been a lovely time each time.
The old podcast switcheroo.
I know. We did a tradesies.
Yeah.
It's kind of like the etiquette of, like, you invite me to your house, I invite you to my house.
Right, exactly.
My mom said that I can go on your podcast if your mom picks us up.
Right. Yeah, no, exactly. It's monetized friendship, which I think is great.
It is. There's always got to be an incentive to the interactions.
A financial incentive, specifically.
I feel like I use the podcast a lot of times to talk to people who are, like, way beyond my sphere.
Absolutely.
Y'all are so far above my station.
Well, not me. No, definitely not me. But I do the same thing on my podcast. I have been able to talk to people who are like, you shouldn't even sniff at me. Like, what are you doing here on my podcast? Like, I've talked to Ed Yong on my podcast. It's like, why are you even spending time talking to me when you could be writing articles? But somehow, it's like, I got a podcast, and then it just tricks them into spending time talking to you.
It's funny because when it's a podcast, you have it recorded and published so that there's forever proof that you had a conversation with that person.
That's right.
Right? So if I'm going to name drop them later, then I can be like, look, I can prove that I actually spoke to this person. I'm not just making this up.
Also, generally, it's just proof that you can have a human conversation, which I think is nice. You know, sometimes people might be doubtful. And it's like, well, you know what? I can actually have a normal human conversation, and I have proof of it, in fact.
The beauty of that is editing, because I actually can't, is the thing.
Right, right.
I'm actually quite bad at it, but the beauty of it is that I edit it afterwards to make it sound like I can. So it's really false advertising.
No, you can't tell people you do that. As far as people know, I never say Mm-mm. And I never smack my lips annoyingly, and we'll keep it that way.
Never done it.
Yeah.
I've never in my entire life started a sentence with no idea where it's going and then halfway through bailed on it and started a different sentence.
And then, like, realized you're lost, start crying, and run away. Yeah, no, that doesn't happen
just
to me either.
Vomiting, peeing everywhere. For folks listening who maybe haven't heard of your podcast and haven't listened to your work before, I would love it if you could let our friends know what got you into the wacky world of science communication podcasting.
Yeah. So I have a podcast called Creature Feature. It's a look at evolutionary biology, but hey, I try to have fun with it. It's basically like all of the stuff that sounds like it's from a horror movie or science fiction, just beyond belief, and presented to you, the listener, in a way that I hope is friendly and approachable. It's like, you don't have to be an evolutionary biologist to listen to it at all. So I started out being very interested in animals when I was a little kid, still interested in it as an adult. I, in college, studied both psychology and evolutionary biology. I couldn't really pick between them. I was interested in both. And then I kind of, as do many graduates do, like, had a period of time where I was like, wait, I don't know how to be an actual adult and how to be in the real world. So I actually worked for a while doing textbook material and educational animations for pharmaceutical researchers. So that was, I mean, that sounds super dry and boring, but it was actually kind of interesting.
Did you say animations for pharmaceutical companies?
Yeah, it sounds bonkers, but it's like for like e-learning.
Oh.
Which back in the mid-2010s was a big, big revolutionary thing, e-learning.
E-learning. So. Back in the time when everything that was like on the internet, you just slap an E in front of it.
Yeah, exactly. And so sort of just animating microbiology for researchers to kind of learn about the products that they're like trying to research or trying to present on. Yeah, my job was just like trying to convert biology into an understandable format through like animation textbooks. And so I kind of had that background, but I was really interested in something more creative. So I got into, I mean, this was a hard turn for me, but comedy writing. And when I sort of shifted to podcasting, I really wanted to do one on evolutionary biology because I've always loved animals, and I love how like weird and creative nature is. In fact, I've always been super interested in parasites. On my first date with my now husband, I spent like 30 minutes talking about parasites, and I had this moment of like, well, I've scared this one off, but he stuck around. So he said he was attracted to the fact that I had a passion like that, even if he found it gross. So there you go.
I love just an immediate litmus test. Yeah. Just like, can you hang? We're going to immediately put you through a trial. First, you must pass this conversational gauntlet that I've prepared for you.
Are you down with parasites? Because if not, I think we're incompatible.
Do you happen to remember which parasites you wooed him with?
I think it was the tongue louse. What is it? Cymothea exigua.
Oh, I'm so glad you said that.
It's a parasitic isopod that latches onto fish tongues.
That's my parasite for today.
Oh, I'm not going to say anything then. It's a secret. It's a secret fun surprise parasite that you'll learn more about.
It's a surprise tool that'll help us later.
It's one of the most devious, sickest parasites in the world. I love it. I'm really excited to talk about it with you.
I think about them every single day. And if you are listening to this and you are in the dating scene, mm-hmm. keep in mind that here you go. This is a first date conversation topic.
Yeah.
Because you can weed them out right then and there.
That ended in a marriage. So again, like, I mean, I would say even save it for the when you start kissing, like, well, did you know about this parasite? Which you'll learn more about later why it's so appropriate for French kissing. But
I was about to say, like, is that when the parasite's going to come into play? Like, by the way, hold on, let me just reach into my mouth here real quick. And here you go.
Right.
But for the sake of science, since that conversation ended in a marriage, for the sake of science, I need to know how many of these conversations result in marriage. Like, we need a greater sample size so that we know what is the effectiveness rate of talking about parasites on your first date.
Also, like, maybe even pickup lines like, hey, I think I might be... wait, hang on.
We got it.
This is why I don't use pickup lines. Okay, collecting myself, getting in the mode. Hey, am I infected with T. gondii, and are you a felid species? Because I'm really into you. That's a good one.
The closer there works with a lot of different parasites.
It does. It does, actually. Because a lot of parasites have this funny thing where they will parasitize one animal, but their final destination is an entirely different animal, and they depend on a very strange life cycle to get to that final animal that they want to be inside. And I'm sure we'll talk more about that later.
Do you mean like an animal will use a different animal as like a stepping stone to like a yet larger mm-hmm. animal?
Yeah, yeah. It's like a parasite will use an animal as a taxi to get to another animal, the one that they actually want to be inside, usually for reproduction purposes. And so they will infect some sort of mediary, middleman animal. There's fun and exciting ways that parasites transport themselves to ultimately find themselves inside the animal species of their choice.
And that is incredible to me because that implies that they had to specialize in not one but two targets.
Yeah,
which is like
bonkers.
Yeah, it requires such a high degree of not just specialization but also planning, right? Like forethought.
Yeah. I mean, it's a funny thing, because when we talk about parasites, we're probably going to use a lot of sort of anthropomorphic terms, like it wants to do this, or right. like it's tricking this thing into this. But we're talking about usually something very tiny, sometimes even a protozoan, or something as simple as like an isopod, which is essentially like an aquatic pill bug. And like these things are not really capable of planning or devious thought. So it really is just evolution driving this, which when you think about it, is it makes my eyes cross a little bit, because within our short human lifespans, it's hard to conceptualize evolution resulting in such fine-tuned little biological robots who are programmed to do such intelligent, devious things. So I look at it as like, basically, evolution is like a programmer who has millions of years to work on these like little flesh robots. And even though evolution itself is not an intelligent being that's like guiding things, it's just that you have a set of rules. They're pretty simple. It's like you are able to pass on your genetic information. And if you do that, like da-da-da-da-da-da, congratulations, you won.
Mission accomplished. Wrap it up.
It's so simple, right? Where it's just like, well, okay, you can pass on your genes. And if you successfully do that, you've done it. And it seems like that should not result in such incredible complexity, but it absolutely does, especially over millions and millions of years. So for the ease of comprehension, I certainly will say things like the parasite wants to be inside here, or it wants to do this. It doesn't really want anything. It just is a little robot that has been fine-tuned over millions of years by natural selection.
This is a concept that I often almost like struggle to wrap my head around, like insect behavior especially, because of how simple it is while also being so complex.
It's so weird. It's like okay, just take a step back. Like, try to rid yourself of the cultural baggage we have of just expecting, you know, these insects to be around us and doing weird stuff. Like, the fact that, you know, you have ants that can farm aphids or something. Like, that's bonkers. Like, it's this little thing. It's just this little guy.
It's just a little guy. And then, like, each individual ant is dumb as a brick, right? Like, there's nothing going on in that little head. Yeah. Not a damn thing. But with enough of them together, they can build a sprawling metropolis that has, like, agriculture and temperature regulation and all sorts of like feats of civic engineering that these dumb little guys are doing.
And it's because each one functions on some simple rules. And the big take home message from like evolutionary biology is that from a relatively simple set of rules, but over either long periods of time or multiplied by many, many units, you have incredible complexity. Because like when you look in our own bodies, like our immune system is incredibly complex. But then if you look down to very simple units like proteins and how they interact, it's like very simple rules, like this protein bonks into this protein and a thing happens. So you have relatively simple rules when you get down to the element, but then when you expand that out, because, you know, not only do we have, you know, many, many proteins per cell, we have many, many, many cells. And so we have like incredible complexity. And so you think about that in terms of evolution, like where you have, yes, you have a single insect, maybe it's dumb. But like when you have like billions and billions of individuals over millions of years being sort of like driven towards a certain outcome through like natural selective pressures, it seems like it's actually kind of inevitable that you get incredible complexity. But it is really hard to intuitively feel like that should be the case.
Right.
It's weird.
So I feel like understanding the underlying mechanisms behind, like, especially like insect behavior or parasite behavior, can help us sort of shift some of the blame off of the individual animal itself, right? Because it's not like they're evil little critters who want nothing more than to kill you or make you have a miserable day. I mean, they might want to, in the sense that that is just the thing that they need to do to survive and reproduce. But, you know, that doesn't make them evil little guys. That just means they're trying to get by. I mean,
yeah, no, yeah, they've
done some fucked up stuff.
Yeah, they have no concept of what they're doing. I mean, it'd be like saying that humans' understanding of the environment, like when we would say chop down a tree or something, that we would have some, like before we had some understanding of like deforestation, that's like, oh, you're evil. It's like, no, you just wanted firewood to be warm. Mm-hmm. And we had no concept. I mean, back then also it was sustainable because we weren't, hadn't pavemented over the entire planet yet. But, you know, we didn't have any concept of like, oh, we shouldn't be, you know, doing this. And so it's a similar thing with these parasites. It's not like they don't have any concept of it. Well, they probably don't have many concepts at all, to be honest. Like, depending on the parasite, you know, parasites can be complex. Like, there are birds who are brood parasites, like the cuckoo. Yeah. And that is, I mean, when people think parasites, they usually think like a little squiggly worm who gets in your body and mm-hmm. eats your guts. Like, that's what we think of as a parasite. But there are a lot of different parasites. There are endoparasites, which is the squiggly worm who gets in your guts and eats you inside.
That is the one, yes.
There are ectoparasites. Those are parasites that are outside your body that will latch on. So a tick or a flea, those are ectoparasites because they're outside of your body, but they are feeding on you from the outside. And then there are things like brood parasites, which are birds like the cuckoo and the cowbird, and they don't actually directly feed on the other animal, but they basically steal their nests. So like a cuckoo, it will find the nest of a host bird species, lay its eggs in that nest, usually just one egg, so one cuckoo, and while these other birds don't realize it. And when that egg hatches, it's like this giant baby bird.
And the cuckoo's like, bye!
Yeah, and the cuckoo then has nothing to do with child rearing. So it's tricked these birds into taking care of its offspring, which benefits the cuckoo because then it doesn't have to invest resource in offspring care. It hurts these other bird species because the cuckoo will kick the other nestlings out of the nest and then also like take resources from the parents. So parasitism is a symbiotic relationship in which one species benefits at the expense of another species. So that's all it is. So anything can be a parasite. It doesn't have to be inside your body. It doesn't have to be feeding on your blood. If it is something that is another species that has a relationship with another species and it's benefiting from that species and then hurting that species, that's what a parasite is.
This might be a little silly of a question, but I'm sorry, I'm going to ask it anyway.
Go for it.
Is predation considered a parasitic relationship?
So, I don't think it is. So, it's kind of one of those things that's a little bit like blurry. There's a lot of stuff in biology where the delineations are sort of blurry.
Because I'm thinking of like a mosquito, which would land on me and suck my blood. That hurts me. I don't like it. It's good for the mosquito. And so, you know, that would be a parasitic interaction, but is that also like a prey, like a predatory interaction?
That's an interesting one because, I mean, I think the idea is like it's something that has kind of a continual relationship with the other species. I do think mosquitoes' relationship with other animals would be considered parasitic, though.
Because I'm thinking, like, if you were a predator and you're preying on another animal, you are eating it. It's good for you. You get a meal. Kind of the ultimate negative consequence for the other animal. They are dead. Making them dead? Bad for them. Don't like being dead.
I mean, some parasites do end up killing their hosts. So it is, yeah, it's one of those things where I think that generally speaking, predation is just categorized as predation because, like, you know, it's a thing eating another thing. And it's like to their detriment, obviously, because they're dead now. But we have these different categories of things. And so I think it's a nuanced distinction. But yeah, I think for predation, it's not necessarily considered parasitism. But it's the distinction is largely just semantics, I think.
I wanted to ask, I figured you would probably be the best person for me to ask, what is your favorite parasite? I want to hear all about your favorite parasite. This is our first date, actually.
Yeah. There we go.
We're on the first date. I want that info dump on your favorite parasite.
Man, I have so many. It's very hard to choose. You know, it's like choosing your favorite child who sucks your blood.
They all do that.
Yeah.
Symbolically.
I would say, like, can I have two favorites? Is that allowed?
You can have two favorites.
Thank you.
You can have as many favorites as you want. I'm not your mom.
Yeah, I would say Leucocluridium paradoxum, as well as Myrmeconema neotropicum, which is hard to say. But these are both parasites that alter the appearance of their host in order to get them eaten by a predator, because these parasites want to be inside a predatory animal, and they have to figure out a vehicle to get inside this animal so that they can complete their life cycle and reproduce inside this other animal.
Oh, so it's not just a taxi. It's a full-on Trojan horse.
Exactly. But then the Trojan horse is alive and you kill it.
It's a Trojan actual living horse, not a wooden one.
Right, exactly. It's like if the Trojans crawled inside the intestines of a horse. But also, not only that, like, somehow made the horse, like, turn neon and flashing with, like, a sign on it saying, like, let me in your castle.
Free horse.
Free horse, yeah. So these are parasites that dramatically alter the appearance of their host in ways that are kind of body horror-esque, honestly.
Oh, I love it.
Yeah.
Let's get Junji Ito in on it.
Very Junji Ito, very much so. Especially the Leucocluridium paradoxum, because there's, I guess not spirals, but definitely like sort of, well, some spirals because it infects a snail.
Oh, well, there you go.
Yeah, so Leucocluridium paradoxum is a teeny tiny flatworm. It lives in temperate forests in North America and Europe. And it will infect a snail who, I feel really bad for these snails. I always like snails. I think they're cool little guys. They're like a slug, but they got a little house. So I feel really bad for the snail in this situation. First, a snail will accidentally eat the eggs of the Leucocluridium flatworm by eating leaves contaminated by bird poop. Now, why is bird poop so dangerous? That's a surprise for later. So the eggs will hatch inside the snail's body, and then the newly hatched flatworms will travel up into the snail's eye stalks.
It's a weird place for them to get.
This is weird because, like, it's not just like a bunch of eggs hatch and then all these little guys go inside the eye sacs. They actually go inside the eye sacs and then start to reproduce asexually in these like giant brood sacs. Again, inside the snail's eye stalks. So you've seen snail eye stalks. They're just these slender little things, and you poke their little eye as a kid and they kind of roll back. You're like, ha, that's
yeah.
neat. And this
yeah, they don't like that.
Poor snail's like, why? Why? But unfortunately for these snails, this is just the beginning of something really, really horrifying. Once inside these eye stalks, like, they form these brood pouches. And again, like, they're going through asexual reproduction until these sacs contain hundreds of new larvae, and these expand. And they cause the snail's eye stalks to swell to huge proportions, to the point where they look weirdly like a couple of fat caterpillars sitting on top of this snail's head.
You know those little squeezy toys that are full of like water? They're like plastic and full of, it's a little like,
it's
a jerk-off thing. You know what I'm talking about? The little squeezy toy that's full of water.
It's the thing when you're too shy to get a fleshlight. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, the Fisher Price fleshlight, I suppose.
Oh, God.
And so, like, I feel like everybody has a story of somebody squeezing it too tight and it bursting. And then you get all the, like, glitter and stuff everywhere. That's what I'm imagining with the snail's eye stalks.
Yeah. It kind of looks like that. And if you squeezed it, a bunch of little parasites would pop out, and that's fun.
Not ideal.
Yeah, I like that. A new toy for kid. It's just a thing to squeeze, and then a bunch of parasites pop out. Yay!
It's a piñata!
It's the world's best piñata, where your surprise is endoparasites. So they go from being these very slender eye stalks to being these huge, fat, undulating eye stalks, because it, like, as these broodstalks actually undulate inside the eye stalks, creating this like hypnotic strobe effect with like these like different bands, like there's red and green and white and yellow bands. It's kind of pretty if you don't think about the horror of it. And so it actually looks like these moving caterpillars on top of this poor snail's head. And this is very attractive to birds because birds like to eat caterpillars. They probably like to eat snails too, but these snails will often try to hang out sort of low down in the foliage, so they're not like at the top where birds can see them. You know, they're duller color, and of course they've got their protective shell, so they have all these protections against birds. But the Leucochloridium just hijacks that, makes them super colorful, these strobe lights, like as if these neon signs, like, here, eat at Joe's, but Joe is the actual snail. So just as intended, like these birds will come and find this very appetizing and they will eat them. And once they are eaten, they will mature into their adult form. And then they can reproduce asexually inside the bird, which is always fun. A lot of parasites like to do that. They like to, like, get inside a larger animal and then, like, have this fun singles bar, like, inside the animal's intestines. And then they poop out their eggs. And this is a great way for the parasite to disperse far and wide. Like, birds are great dispersal tools for plants. And in this case, for parasites.
Oh, for sure. If you can get inside a bird, you want to get in that bird. That bird's going to take you far and wide.
Right, exactly. So they use, like, the snail as a taxi to get to the bird, which is like the airport where they join the Mile High Club, mate, and then the bird, like, poops out their offspring.
The snail is the little airport shuttle mm-hmm. that takes you to...
Exactly.
To your gate.
Exactly. So quite disgusting, but also amazing. If you have the stomach for this kind of thing, I would definitely recommend Googling Leucochloridium paradoxum. Gosh, it's a hard word to spell. If you just Google snail eye stalk parasite, that might be easier. And then, like, look for a GIF or a video of it, because it is quite hypnotic to look at.
Yeah, I regret to inform you that I have done this thing and... I don't know that I love that. It's a little challenging to look at.
Yeah, it's a little gushy, a little bit ooky, but if you put like a good beat behind it, it's a little more tolerable. Like if you have a good like bass line or like you drop the beat on it, it's kind of like kind of fun. That.
It, mm-hmm. This feels sexual, doesn't it? It looks almost a little bit. Doesn't it?
I mean,
sort of pulsing movement with like a phallic shape to it. I don't know about this.
It is definitely phallic. It's a little bit coquettish, I would say.
I can see it.
But it's definitely appealing to not the sexual appetite of the bird, although that would be quite interesting. If you want to talk about something that's weirdly, vaguely sexual, we should also talk about the Myrmeconema neotropicum, which I hate saying the Latin name for it. I like to say the berry butt parasite.
So it shall remain.
Yes. It is like the only instance of fruit-based mimicry in the animal kingdom that we know of. So this guy, the berry butt parasite, is a parasitic nematode. So it's a tiny roundworm. And it parasitizes a species of ant from South America. So far, so good. But like the Leucochloridium, this parasite has this like shuttle service to the airport system. It also wants to get inside a bird. There's so many parasites that want to like get in a bird. So
it's a great spot if you can get to it. Like if right, you can get exactly. in, the wait list is so long. You right. gotta call ahead months for reservations.
There's a bouncer like at the mouth of the bird, really being selective.
Yeah, and he does not take bribes.
Exactly. So this is a similar story where the parasite wants to be in the bird. And so the eggs are pooped out by the bird, And so these eggs will be eaten by the ant of the C. atreides species. It's just like a normal looking ant. It's like black, shiny, kind of a funny head. It's got sort of a blocky head. It's actually also known as the gliding ant because they, like, if they fall out of a tree, they can sort of use their legs and their butt to steer and glide while falling because they live in trees. They're arboreal. And so being able to, like, not fall all the way to the forest floor, but, like, redirect themselves onto the tree can be really useful.
That is important. You don't want to be taking fall damage in that forest.
Exactly. I don't know if it's so much for injury as it is for, like, being on the forest floor where there are a bunch of predators and stuff, and then, like, they have to climb all the way up the tree, which is annoying.
It's a pain in the ass.
It really is. Speaking of pain in the ass, our parasitic nematode, once it is ingested by these ants, it's got plans, big plans for these ants, which are very ass-based plans. So the ant will actually pick up the eggs in the bird dookie, thinking that they're a source of food. And then they actually feed them to the ant larva. So these ants are unwittingly dooming their own babies because they're feeding the parasite to their own larva because they think it's food. And then the larva will start to mature into a fully grown ant. But as they're doing that, the butt parasites are also developing inside the ant, reproducing inside the ant's gaster. So the gaster is like the butt of the ant. It's that final caboose of the ant.
It's the cake.
It's the cake. It's. I mean, in this case, it truly is cake because inside the gaster, the male and female nematodes are having sex inside the ant's butt. So it's this like funny two-stage reproduction. Again, like remember for the Leucochloridium, it had this asexual reproduction inside the eye stalks of the snail and then sexual reproduction inside the bird. Well, here we have another two-stage reproduction where it's having sexual reproduction inside the ant's butt. And later on, it's going to have another stage of reproduction inside the bird. So how does it get from ant butt to bird? Well, as these nematodes are mating inside the ant butt, they are changing the butt. They're causing it to swell, become bright red instead of black, and it looks like a berry.
Well, the first thing you got to do when you move into a new place is, like, decorate it, right?
Right,
you
got to make it your exactly. own.
You got to start painting the walls, you know.
Making it look like a big juicy berry. Yeah, who's that, like, who's the girl from Willy Wonka who, like, turned into a blueberry?
Oh, is it Veruca Salt?
I thought Veruca Salt was the rich one.
Maybe that was her.
I know who you're talking about. Veruca Salt, I thought, was the one who got attacked by squirrels or something.
You're probably right.
Willy I'm Googling Wonka. It.
Oh, her name's Violet. Because I remember she said Violet. She's right, turning Violet. How could
right,
I forget that?
Okay, yeah. Well, it's like that, except only with the ant's butt. So it really like there is a type of berry in this forest that like because they live in these like Peruvian rainforests that look exactly like this ant's butt. Like exactly. Like you could accidentally pick this ant when looking for these berries. So the ants also are, for some reason, compelled to kind of hold their butts upwards. So elevating that fake berry butt to put it even more on display.
Listen, when you've just got a BBL and like you're real proud of it and it's looking Look, real nice, you would too, wouldn't you? Wouldn't you be holding it up a little bit?
Do you park your Porsche in a garage so no one can see it or put that on display?
Exactly.
That's what I'm talking about. Yeah. So because they hold their butt up, this actually makes it more visible to birds and kind of advertises it to birds. Also, the parasite makes the ants more slow and sluggish, just like making them the perfect edible victim for these birds. And again, weirdly, like through this transformation process of like ant butt into berry, like it becomes a lot more easily detached from the ant's body. So like if the ant is like clawing onto a branch and the bird like wants to get at that berry butt, the berry butt just kind of like pops off, which is still not good for the ant. Let me be clear. An ant's not going to do good when its whole entire butt is ripped off.
Nor would I.
No.
I'm nothing.
No.
I'm
Where
nothing
would I
without-
sit? Where would I sit? The bird is actually, in this case, a little bit more of a transportation system for the eggs. So, like, they will carry these eggs far and wide and, you know, keep them safe inside of them and then poop them out. And poop them out near another ant colony, potentially. And then the whole horrifying cycle begins anew, where another ant will pick up the bird poop, think it's delicious food for some reason, and then feed this to their offspring. And then there you go, a whole other berry butt phenomenon.
Does this worm then have any ill effect on the bird? Is the bird just fine?
I don't know of any problems it causes the bird to be honest. I mean,
clearly their butt's not falling off. So, like, no. That's an improvement.
I think it just passes right through the bird. I think the bird is just used as an egg taxi.
Do you think the ants are like, man, what the fuck? What? Like, the ants are getting completely ravaged. The ant is getting just absolutely murked, and the bird gets off essentially scot-free. This is unfair.
Yeah. Well, life isn't necessarily so fair.
Well, you mentioned that this is a unique case of fruit mimicry in animals. I would like to remind you of the little pumpkin costumes that babies wear for Halloween.
That is true. And we could see Spirit Halloween as a sort of parasite, right? Because it latches onto a store and takes it over.
It's more of a decomposer, I think.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that makes sense. A detritivore, yeah.
Because they kind of move into the carcass of like an already decaying store.
I see. Yeah. I guess they are kind of the crab of the retail kingdom.
You see like a Sears dead and rotting on the bottom of the ocean floor, and then a bunch of little like Spirit Halloween skitter in from the abyss and all start like breaking down the rotting carcass.
Yeah. There's some hagfish in there. Yeah. No, absolutely.
It is a flourishing ecosystem.
It really is. I admire.
Unique biome.
Yeah, no. It may be ugly. We may not like them, but it does it a very important service, just like the detritivores of the ocean or the forest. It's like, oh, really? Like these guys? Like you see a worm or you see a Spirit Halloween and you're like, oh, not this again. But yeah, it's a very important cycle of life. Love that latex smell, though, just huffing it. Yeah, you know, the smell inside a cheap mask.
We took our 2-year-old to Spirit Halloween for the first time recently, and he was vibing with it. Everything was great. We were going really well. He was having the time of his life putting on every hat he could get his hands on. There were so many hats. And like all the hats are down close to the ground so he could grab the hats and just put them on. So he's loving it, living it up in a state of bliss. And then an animatronic clown started moving and just the wrong sound. Like just an incorrect noise altogether.
Right.
And that was it. That was game over.
Was this a scary clown?
Yes, it was a scary clown, unfortunately.
Yeah.
So, did not clock that one in time.
Yeah.
And he just ran right up to it, and that was the end of our Spirit Halloween trip.
God, motion activated animatronics and toddlers sound like the worst combination you could possibly think of.
So one of our neighbors down the street had one of the had a 12-foot tall skeleton that would like do the animatronics. It would like move and make sounds.
What?
And stuff.
I didn't realize they have animatronic 12-foot tall skeletons.
Yes, and like the eyes lit up on the inside and all this stuff. And their whole situation was so terrifying to the toddler that still to this day, when we pass that house, he still is like a little sketch about it.
Honestly, the kid's got a point. Like when you think about it, it's ridiculous that we are able to put 12-foot tall animatronic skeletons in our backyards. And adults, I think, and older kids, I guess, like we have been properly gaslit by our culture that that's fine and cool. But like a 2-year-old is like, no, it's literally a moving 12-foot tall skeleton. Are you kidding me?
Right. They're operating on base instincts.
Right. They're operating on basically how we should view the world, which is like a 12-foot tall skeleton is not something to fuck around with.
Right. That's an absolutely not.
So your kid's like, mother, this house was haunted, if you'll remember, and we're just walking by it.
like it never happened.
There was a dead giant in the front yard that moved. And you're like, fine with that?
Also, he's two. So to him, there probably doesn't appear to be that much difference between a 12-foot tall skeleton and a 6-foot tall skeleton, right? Like the scale between 12 feet and 6 feet isn't as obvious when you are, you know, only 2 or 3 feet tall.
Kids are really bad at scale, actually. Yeah,
so bad at it. So to him, indistinguishable from a normal-sized skeleton.
Right. Actually, like, it's funny you mentioned that. Kids are really bad at, like, the scale of thing up until a certain age. I don't remember what age it is, but it's somewhere between sort of baby and toddler. And so, like, people will, like, in these research studies that are, like, the funniest ones ever, they will give kids, like, toys, like a miniature slide or a little car, like, that you pedal around in. And then, like, miniature versions of them, like, doll-sized versions. And then, like, just let them play with it. And these kids will, like, try to get inside the mini car and try to, like, go down the miniature slide. And it's really funny.
I could see that happening. I have memories in my head, right, of, like, playgrounds that I played on as a kid that in my mind they towered over the landscape. And then I revisit them as an adult and it's, like, 4 feet tall.
Yeah, yeah, of course. I mean, it's really hard to understand proportional sizes of things as a kid or sometimes as an adult like me who, like, frequently bonks into things. I'm like, where did that come from? And it's just literally right there.
So it's like, can we blame them for having tiny eyes that are close to the ground? It's not their fault.
No, not at all.
Can I tell you about my favorite parasite?
I want that so bad. Tell me.
Okay, so we've already hinted at it. We had a little teaser, a little appetizer of this parasite at the top.
And a mousse bouche.
Just a little hors d'oeuvre.
And a mousse bouche. Bouge, bouge.
Mousse bouche.
A mousse bouche.
One of those was probably it, I'm sure.
I went through a lot of them, so statistically speaking, I'm right at least once.
Maybe I can just take out whichever ones were wrong and then leave the right one. Okay.
Don't be a coward.
Stand in your truth.
Right.
So my favorite parasite is the tongue-eating louse.
Love it.
Louse is already a weird name for what they are. Because when you say louse or lice, you typically think probably the little guys on your head. These are not those. These are isopods. So isopods are little crustaceans that are related to roly-polies. Like roly-polies exactly. Are a type of isopod.
It's crazy because like we have these land isopods like roly-polies, pill bugs, potato bugs, and they're slightly different species of these that we see on land. And like, imagine that, but like, there's deep sea isopods, which are just like huge versions of them. And it's
and I'm obsessed bonkers. With them. Let me tell you this, okay, about the deep sea isopods. We just this summer went to Monterey Bay, California, to go to the Monterey Bay Aquarium because they had a giant isopod touch tank.
Oh my God, I had no idea, and I want that so bad for me. I'm happy it happened for you, and I want it for me.
I got to touch a marine isopod. That's a big, fantastic. One of the big chunky boys.
What did it feel like?
Very hard, very rough, had a very kind of a bumpy exterior. Actually, like if you've ever touched like the outside of like a crab's shell,
yeah.
It feels like a crab's
shell. I'm touching crabs all the time.
I'm really not a crab toucher.
Every opportunity I get, I touch a crab.
But it makes sense when you think about the fact that they're crustaceans. Like, yeah. Then you're like, okay, yeah, that tracks. But so, you know, a lot of these isopods, like roly-polies and the giant isopods, are detritivores, where they live on the bottom. For roly-polies, it's like in leaf litter and dirt. And for marine isopods, it's on the bottom of the ocean. And they just pick up, like, dead and decaying stuff. And they just eat that because it's an easy meal. Why wouldn't you?
Yeah.
But a lot of isopods, like this one, are, instead of that, they're parasites. Which seems more difficult, actually. Like, why don't you just eat what's there? Anyway, not my business.
Competition. It's less competitive. Like, if you can find your niche, you know, you gotta go for it.
So a lot of them like latch onto the bodies of larger animals. That's kind of how they get around because they're not good swimmers. Marine isopods even like trawl along the bottom. They'll swim up the water column sometimes, but they're really bad at it. So what they do instead is they latch on to the bodies of larger animals like fish or mammals. A lot of isopods like to get up into the gills. So like a lot of fishers will fish up a fish and then, you know, look in the gills and there you go. You've got like a bunch of isopods slapped onto the inside of it where they're clinging
on. Gotta shake those out.
Yeah. And when they're in the gills, a lot of times they might be either sucking its blood or they might just be like feeding off of food that's drifting by. Like as the water's flowing into the gills, they might just nip plankton out of it and stuff like that.
It's like a dining car, you know?
Yeah.
Just like, it's like your in-flight meal.
Yeah, you just grab what floats by. It's kind of like at a Brazilian steakhouse. You just grab right. What comes to the table, basically.
Yeah, or those sushi bars where they have the little conveyor belt and you can just like grab you what just you grab want. It. They have ones that are like little boats that float by, which seem really cute. I love that.
So the isopod, there are like hundreds of species of parasitic isopods. There's tons and tons of them that do all sorts of different things. And so the ones, it's not even one particular species that does this, but there's one that it does it in a slightly different way than everybody else. So that's the one I'm going to say I'm talking about. And it is a Cymothoa exigua. And these are tongue-eating lice. All of them are born male. They're born male by default.
The patriarchy.
But they don't stay that way forever. So when they're a male, they're in their larval stage. They're little guys, and they're much better at swimming in their larval stage. So they swim around in the water looking for a host, which is just a fish, like swimming by. So they find one, they latch onto the inside of the gills and hold on. And that's where they'll kind of chill out for a while. Then they have to wait for another one to show up. So another tongue-eating louse has to then show up and latch onto the gills. So the first one can tell that a new one just showed up. And then he's like, oh, time to mature, time to get moving, time to, you know, go move on to the next stage of the life cycle. That's when he matures into a female. So mm-hmm. He has to go through the experience of maturing to become female.
Hear that, fellas?
So he matures into a female, and then she crawls up the gills, tunnels through the throat, and then emerges the fish's mouth. Oh, yes. That's got to be snug in there, right? Mm-hmm. A fish's
throat. Get right in that throat, yeah.
Yeah, and just comes up out the throat. Which, you know, that's never the direction you want things to move through the throat.
No, generally not.
You want it to be a sort of a one-way sort of situation. Right. But she does. She crawls up through the throat. She emerges in the fish's mouth. And then once she's in the fish's mouth, she has really sharp claws. Like, she's just full of these tiny sharp claws. And she uses her front claws to just snip, snip, snip the blood vessels that are supplying blood to the fish's tongue. So she drinks the blood out of the tongue, like eats the tongue, because the tongue is delicious, nutritious. It's just sitting there. She then uses her back legs to attach her body to the nub that the tongue used to be attached to. So she's like, look at me. I am the tongue now.
I'm the tongue now. Yeah.
She's in its place where it once was. So usually they will have already mated when she was still like in the gills and throat. So she goes up here. This is where she broods her eggs. She has a marsupium, like a little pouch that she keeps her little eggs in. And this is kind of her little nursery. She turns it into a cute little nursery
for babies. Like she can, kids, like she's got like 24/7 like free smoothies, which is fish tongue blood. And she can like stay nourished as she's like brooding her offspring and then have free transportation. It's perfect.
Yeah, it's going great. And a very Pinterest nursery theme.
Right. Fish mouth.
Can you imagine that mood board of like fish the mouth. Inside of a fish mouth?
Yeah. Did you know that fish mouth actually is good for your baby's cognitive development? Like when the walls are painted in fish mouth color?
I love color theory. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Painting your walls fish mouth color and playing Mozart will make your baby smart.
That's all you need, actually.
Yeah.
I heard that Albert Einstein's nursery was a fish mouth.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So in some like rare instances, this is pretty rare, but it's also unique to this Exigua species of isopod. Some kinds of fish can actually use the isopod in the same way that they were using their old tongue. Because the tongue is used to like push food up and like help break down larger pieces of food, but it's also used to push water back through the throat over the gills. So it helps water flow properly so that they can breathe. And it's not super common, but some species of fish can just be like, this is fine. Guess I'll make
do. It's my tongue now. Yeah.
Yeah. This is, I guess, this is whatever. Because what else are you going to do? Die?
You got to improvise. You got to adapt. You know, you got to be adaptable.
Play with the hand you're dealt. Yeah. So some can just do that, which is very unusual. So this makes the isopod a functional replacement for the tongue, which is useful to the isopod because keeping the fish alive for longer means that the fish can keep swimming to find other fish. So once they're done with that fish, basically, and she sends her little babies off into the ether of the ocean, if that fish has already swam back to other fish, that means her babies have plenty of opportunities to find hosts. So she wants to keep the fish alive for as long as she can. The problem is that with the fish's tongue gone, the isopod is left without a constant food supply. Like, it's not going to be like perpetually feeding off of stuff. So she's kind of already, the clock is ticking for her. She's living off of stored food. She doesn't have that much longer left, but she has already reproduced. So for her, like you were talking about earlier, how like with evolution, the goal is just kind of to make more of you. And she's done that, right? So she's like, anything else after this, I don't care about. Yeah, mission accomplished. We're good. We're done here. Wrap it up.
Right.
But not only is this not ideal for the isopod, who has now consumed its only available food source, but the fish doesn't have a tongue now.
Right. So yeah. Yeah, like the ice, it's funny because like with these isopods, they're like, hey, I'm going to just replace your tongue now. And then these fish, it's like, okay, I can work with that. But then when the isopod at the end of its sort of reproductive life cycle, like detaches from the fish's tongue and like leaves, and it's like, all right, I'm out of here. And then the fish is like, wait, what the fuck? Like,
oh, no. Uh-oh. Come back. So, and that's so unnecessary, too. Like, you don't have to do that. You don't have to do the fish like that.
Yeah, I mean, there's no morality when it comes to these isopods. It's just like...
Yeah. But also, like, the isopod can't really swim well enough to go like find a new host or something like that. And so like if it does either detach from the fish, a lot of times it just gets swallowed. Like she just dies and the fish swallows her and that's it. But even if she does like detach from the fish, she's just gonna sink. Like nothing. Yeah. That's just the end for her. She's just done. So like basically every single time they do this, this is a pure 1-to-1 KDR. Like they're taking out their host and themselves in one fell swoop every time, which is like, there's got to be a more effective way.
I mean, it's kind of salting the earth. Like, you know, it's like that one person when you're like partying and like they're done partying, so they make sure everyone else is done partying too. Like dumps their drink on someone else or shuts off the music or, you know, calls the cops. Like they're done partying, so everyone else has to be done now too.
Right. If I can't have it, nobody can.
Right. If I can't stay in this fish mouth, nobody can have my fish mouth.
Nobody can have my fish mouth. I'm just like, there are so many better ways to do this. Like you could just not take the tongue out of the fish and just leave that there and find literally any other thing that you can just mooch off of.
It's very petty.
It's so unnecessary, but it's also hilarious because like, as you can imagine, a lot of times, like people who fish out in the ocean or something, a lot of times will pull up a fish and then go to like take the hook out of its mouth or something like that. And oh, who's that looking back at you?
Yeah.
It's just a little
like
guy.
This little guy. Like, hey there. This is awkward.
I was reading this article in The Atlantic, and it's called The Mystery at the Base of One of Biology's Strangest Relationships, and it's by Catherine J. Wu, and she talked to Dr. Corey Evans, who is a fish biologist at Rice University, and his quote in this is, he's talking about the experience of, like, looking inside of a fish's mouth, and then, oh, there's a little surprise isopod looking back at you. And he says, every time is as bad as the first time. It's like being Rickrolled.
That's so funny.
And the pictures of it are so goofy. Like, you can find pictures of this online. This is not as, like, viscerally terrifying as the eye stalks of the snail that are, like, kind of having a little EDM rave moment. This is a little bit more palatable, I think, unless you're just weird about mouth stuff.
I mean, I don't think not wanting a giant isopod parasite in your mouth isn't being weird about mouth stuff. Let's be a little fair here.
But I think the isopod's a little cute also.
It's a little cute. It's got like little beady eyes, sort of a face kind of thing going on.
Yeah. It's also reminiscent of like Alien, right?
Yeah.
How like there's a smaller alien inside of the larger alien's mouth.
Yeah, yeah. Like the little guy just like, it's kind of cute where it's like.
I think it's kind of cute at least.
Like with the alien, with the little alien in its mouth, it's kind of cute where it's like the big one is like scary. I'm going to eat you. It's like, me too.
My understanding was always that those two were like two parts of the same organism. So I don't know. If it's terribly comparable.
Yeah, no, it's not. It's more like an extra set of pharyngeal jaws that, like, eels have.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But yeah, no, the parasitic isopod, it's like, I mean, it definitely does not have a smile. It's just the structure of its face, but it almost looks like it's got, like, a little, like, V-shaped smile. And it's just like, hey there.
If you like roly-polies, this is a cute one.
If you like big, sort of white roly-polies that live inside fish mouths.
As far as parasites go, this is not the grossest. Like, it's conceptually very, very gross, like, as an idea, but, like, in practice, it's, I think, one of the cutest little parasites there is.
I rate parasite grossness based on whether I would touch it or not, and this one would. Yeah, would touch.
I think I'd touch it. Well, you know what? I am weird about fish, though. I have a little bit of a phobia of fish. And so don't think I would be. It's really touching the fish is the bigger barrier to me than touching the creepy little isopod.
If I can ask, what is it about the fish touch that is bad?
I think it is the unpredictability of the movement of the fish.
Ah, so you it's know a how, live.
It's the right. Live fish thing, right? And the fish are always like flopping around and in a very erratic and unpredictable sort of motion. Something about the way that fish move around when they're outside of the water is viscerally terrifying to me, to the point that like my brain shuts off and I'm just like, I have to put as much distance as I can between me and this thing. Like, I don't go like fishing on boats.
Are dead fish okay then?
You know, I always just, it's kind of that same feeling of if you've ever tried to pick up like a dead spider or a dead cockroach, how you're like, I mentally know it's dead, but.
I do that and then pop it right in my mouth.
Yeah, just, that's a little free snack. Just a little snack.
Ooh, free protein.
It's floor candy.
No, I get that. I get that. Where you're almost like afraid it's going to come back to life and like crawl under your skin or something. Yeah.
So I wouldn't touch it on the grounds of it being inside of a fish.
Right. I see. But if you could pop it out of the fish, then you'd give it a pet.
Yeah, just a little boop.
A little one. A little boop.
As we wrap up for today, I would love it if you could let our friends listening know where they can find your work. Where can people follow along with you and keep up with your activities?
My journey on this wild place we call podcasting. Yeah.
Yeah, where can people walk alongside you and leave their footprints in the sand next to you?
Right. Because you're in my mouth as my little tongue louse.
The times when there was one pair of footprints was the time I was parasitizing your mouth.
Right, exactly. That's a sweet sentiment. I love that. So, yeah, my podcast is called Creature Feature. It's hosted by iHeartRadio. I've actually had Ellen on the show before. So, what did we talk about?
We talked about Pokemon.
Pokemon, that's right. Animals that are like Pokemon. And yes. Ellen's Pokemon knowledge is much vaster than mine. So she was of extreme help for me on that podcast. And so the podcast is just about evolutionary biology, about the world's most incredible evolutionary strategies, animals that for me blow my mind. So I just share them with you. And yeah, you do not have to have any knowledge of the topic to listen to it. Like, I try to make it, you know, just kind of fun, maybe a little sassy sometimes, jazz it up, who knows? But yeah, we talk about a lot of parasites, but also a lot of other animals, sometimes really cute, like objectively cute animals. So it's not always disgusting, but some of my favorite episodes are the disgusting ones.
I always find there's so much more to talk about with the really gross ones, because all the animals that are like really, really cute are usually like, yep, it's a mammal.
Yeah.
It sure does exist.
Usually I talk about the gross elements of the cute animal, like, you know, the square poop of a wombat, or like the deer eating their own antler skin. And it's like, see, they're not so cute. They're disgusting like the rest of us.
We have to knock them down a few peg, bring them down to our level.
makes them more relatable, I think.
Where can folks follow along with you individually?
As it exists currently, I suppose. Who knows? You can find, who knows? I mean, like, I am still on Twitter at Katie Golden. Who knows if I will still be on in the future? It's a little bit turbulent, we'll say. But you can find me at Katie Golden on Twitter. I'm not super active on Instagram. That might change. But again, like, if you look up Katie Golden on Instagram, I'm there. But it's like, I think just like 5 pictures of my dog. So if you're interested in seeing that, that's what is going on with that.
For those primo dog pics.
Yeah. And so my last name is, or my name is spelled KATIEGOLDIN. Spelled it wrong. My ancestors were like, whoops, spelled it wrong.
Better not change that ever.
Right. That's how that works.
They didn't have a, you know, autocorrect or spell check or anything back then. So I don't blame anybody for getting anything wrong ever. Well, Katie, thank you so much. It has been a delight. I think there will be a second date.
Thank you.
Maybe we'll get married now that we've shared all this information about parasites together.
I always thought about dabbling in bigamy.
Just bigamy, though. No more after me. That's where I draw the line.
It's awfully big of me to allow that boundary. Well, thank you so much for having me. I always love to talk about parasites, and this is super fun.
It was. I appreciate you so much. We'll talk to you later. Thanks for listening. I'll be back in 2 weeks with an episode with Ashley about spontaneous human combustion. Follow on social media to keep up with the show as it grows, or let us know what you thought and leave a good review if you liked what you heard. Our theme music is Snake Oil by Doug Organ. If you made it this far, here's a palate cleanser. Nervous racehorses are often provided with companion goats who accompany them to races, staying with them in the stall and keeping them calm for the big day. Until next time, I'm Ellen Weatherford. Thanks. Bye.